From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on sabbatical until October. Governor Jay Inslee called lawmakers to a second extra legislative session, which means the third legislative session since January. It all started bright and early Wednesday morning. Democrats say Republicans are holding them hostage over policy bills. Republicans say there would be no problem at all if the Democrats would just vote for their budget. Meanwhile, something happened last night in Olympia. The flash, news flash. Governor Inslee today signed into law a very last minute fix to the estate tax loophole. That is going on in Olympia, in the city of Seattle, big duking it out over whether to close Nicholsville September 1st and what to do about this ongoing problem of homelessness in the city and, in fact, in the county. Joining me, as they do almost every Friday, our esteemed panel of journalists, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, about to be a guest on Science Friday later this morning, very exciting, which you can hear on KUOW2 Live. And Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, is here as well. And I wanted to talk about Governor Inslee signing the estate tax loophole, not about the estate tax loophole itself, but it just seems like, I don't know how many days it's been that the lawmakers have been down there, but something actually happened.
That's why everybody's so excited, because the endurance contest that is known as the 2013 legislature actually did something. The two sides got together. They got a bill to the governor's office. Holy moly, here we go. And the bill that they did, this was nothing like a deadline, as they say, to make you do something.
Very deadline.
Very deadline. The deadline, this was all done by 2 a.m. in the morning. The deadline was 9 a.m. this morning to do this fix on the estate tax, whereby money would have actually had to start going out, $160 million going out in refunds because of a sort of a legislative and court mess over some of the rules of the estate tax.
So really, it was they were looking at the check is almost in the mail. And
the check was almost in the, I don't know if they do that direct deposit stuff.
I have
that
no idea.
Newfangled thing.
They were talking about mail, but there were two things. One, deadline, Joni, but also, Eli, the idea is actually you can reach compromise.
You can reach compromise once everyone.
What, they got to turn on your microphone. There you are. There you are.
Am I back on?
You are.
You can reach compromise once everyone is done playing their brinkmanship games. They will push this on every single issue there this year and other years, actually, until the very last minute and see who blinks. And finally, someone blinked on this. And, you know, like Joni said, I got an email about this at like 12:01 a.m. last night from the governor's office saying, okay, we have a deal on this. And it was all under threat of $160 million going out the door at a time when obviously we can't afford to have that happening if people don't think it's a good idea. And the sort of loophole or glitch that people are talking about was, as I understand it, and it's pretty complicated, but essentially married couples were getting away with not paying, or potentially getting away with not paying, estate tax that single people or divorced people would have to pay. It kind of was a function of the law not being written right to begin with. So they've solved that, and the state gets to hold on to money that will go to the education trust fund. But again, you know, $160 million, that's a drop in the $1 billion bucket that they need to fill.
So explain to me, somebody, walk me back to why anybody would want this loophole to stay in place.
It had occurred from a court case whereby they, you know, where they had allowed the marriage, those who were married, to have this. But of course, everyone says, well, that's not fair. And so we as a legislature need to fix this.
Right. They were going to have to pay refunds, excuse me, to people who had already paid this tax, so they wanted to avoid having to give the money back, and obviously wanted to continue to collect the money going forward. One of the significant things about it is you have Republicans actually voting for something that would not let revenue escape. So, which
not a new tax, though.
Well, that's right. They don't have to. They've expressed concern about that there might be additional court action over making this retroactive. So there's still some you know, some question and whatnot. But it, you know, at this point, are we worried that Jay Inslee is going to start suffering from writer's cramp because the massive bills are going to come through?
Well, he got
a little practice last night. We don't know what it means, but it is a little piece of progress in the many layers of leveraging over legislation related to the budget.
You, Eli used that verb blink, and John Stang writing in Crosscut also led his story with, like, who's going to blink first? And I believe it was Don Benton, a Republican, who was quoted this week someplace as saying, well, you know, it would all be fine if the Democrats would just approve our budget. I think that's the quote.
Well, that is at least half of the problem that leads to the fact that we may have a government shutdown, partial probably, here in the state of Washington, which looks, you know, doesn't look good for any player there. There is a little bit of early finger pointing, like, if this happens, I'll blame you. But I don't know that the voter will get down into the weeds that much and just blame them all. That's probably how that goes. In reading about this anticipated shutdown, if they can't reach just a regular operating budget, I had forgotten that Booth Gardner took it to 2 minutes to midnight years ago, that this actually has almost happened before. Gary Locke took it to 1 year to June 20th. So today's the 14th.
We've got weeks.
We've got eons, tons of time for everyone to say this would only work if you went my way.
One thing we can say for sure is that the promise of that majority coalition in the Senate, or at least the promise that Rodney Tom offered, has not come through.
The promise being that we're going to focus on the budget.
Yeah, that we're actually going to get things done, that this will be a way of bringing bipartisanship rather than more gridlock. And what we've seen is more gridlock. Nothing has gotten done in a timely manner. We're now in our second extra session, and the only way that anything passes is by waiting until the stroke of midnight.
Yeah, I mean, that part of the irony of the whole thing, and I wrote a piece about this a while ago, about what the sort of value and ethics of centrism, political centrism, and the whole idea of centrism is that it actually makes things work, because, as Eli was suggesting, you actually break gridlock. Mm-hmm. You use mm-hmm. it as a force to break gridlock. In this case, it actually created gridlock. The question will be how they're able to resolve it. The other thing I think that's kind of getting lost in all the who's going to blink part is that no matter which budget they approve, it will be inadequate. There will be too many cuts in social services. There'll be too many cuts to programs that fund low-income housing. There are too many cuts to the state parks. They're restoring a lot of money to the parks budget, but it's not adequate. There's kind of a whole sequence of stuff here that we're talking about education, and we're talking about the budget, but we're losing sight of the overall picture, which is none of it is sufficient.
We're talking over the week's news, and Rico emails in. Any of you covering the budget area where the Liquor Control Board's trying to get full control over medical marijuana and combine it with recreational pot? All I know is that
me personally, but I do know that they're not writing it in, but there will be a time when the new rules on pot will actually be revenue plus for the state of Washington. But that doesn't occur. Somebody correct me here if I get this wrong. I don't think that occurs until late in the second year of the budget.
Right. Well, it can't, because there is no state infrastructure
right.
in place
right.
this year. We have this 1 year waiting period, or I don't know how to describe it, trial period, while the state figures out its rule for
and the rules got delayed. There was the draft of a draft, and the actual draft issuing of the draft got delayed. I believe that was announced this week, and part of it is over what seal you put on the grown in Washington seal that goes on the pot that you.
I missed this. Is it about whether it's organic? Or whether it's...
Well, there is actually part of that, but my colleague Amy Radel has a story, and I don't want to quote it because I don't have the transcript in front of me, but the seal itself, the initial design was a state with a big green marijuana leaf superimposed on it.
I see.
And I'm pretty sure that some people were not happy with that in the legislature.
So it shouldn't have the state or it shouldn't have the marijuana? Which one?
I don't know.
Okay.
They're happy to take the money. They just don't want the least
shown.
Just
don't put my name on.
Well, it brings up so many images of, you know, baggies of marijuana with, you know, grown in Washington on the outside. I don't, you know, like potatoes or apples. I don't know if that's the intent. It can't possibly be, can it? No.
Well, branding, marketing, all that stuff is coming.
Well, it's all delicate because, you know, we're one of the leaders in this, so it's all delicate. That makes sense.
Before we leave the issue of state politics and move on to another topic, an article came out this week about the late Governor Rossellini and his ties to crime, criminal activities, and was this a surprise? And B, you know,
it certainly wasn't a surprise. You know, throughout his time in office, Rossellini was dogged by some of his associations with different folks. This story also got into some of the ways that perhaps he would require people to make campaign donations to him in exchange for sort of favors along the, you know, having to do with liquor and other things like that. You know, the interesting thing is he was never really charged with anything. He just, it was just these sort of shadowy things. And there were sometimes anti-Italian, anti-Catholic things against him. So it was very hard to kind of parse through it all. In the story that I read, his Republican political opponent, former Governor Dan Evans, was really gracious, you know, to say that, you know, there was a lot of talk, but none of it was ever proved. Skip has a comment on this, and I'm going to
I was going to say the Evans machine was a lot less gracious to Rossellini when they were running against him, there were people on the campaign's behalf who leaked stories and got stories in the newspaper that were very unflattering and suggested that he had very suspicious ties to nightlife figures. So I think there is some truth to the idea that he had an Italian name, that some of the, you know, that he was a long time connected with Frank Colacurcio. He was Frank Colacurcio's lawyer back in the 1950s, got him on a statutory rape charge, and they continued to have a relationship which became public in a way that it hadn't really before during the whole Strippergate campaign donation scandal a few years back. But I think that most of that, I mean, you know, he was never charged with anything. There was never any proof of illegal wrongdoing. FBI files are great for gossip. Mm-hmm. The FBI never did an investigation, a criminal investigation of Rossellini, but he was being vetted for a possible federal appointment during the Johnson administration.
That was really interesting. We never knew which job it was, and he certainly didn't get it.
But, you know, so they go around, they knock on doors, they get all the dirt and look at it and decide, you know, whether that's worth reporting. But I think it's good that that material, that the AP got it and that it's out there from a historical standpoint. It's important to get a full picture.
And it sounded like the head of the FBI office here concluded that he was definitely a scoundrel. That was the word that he used.
We don't use that word all that often.
Enough anymore. Yeah. No.
It's a good retro word. So scoundrel, but nothing rising to the level of the FBI actually coming out and charging him with anything. So I did think that was surprising, given the heat of the gossip about him and the just long-standing rumors.
And we have such, you know, under the surface, roiling scoundrelism in Washington State. It's, you know, in Chicago or Boston or New York, the scoundrels are right out in front, and you know their scoundrelhood. Well, I want to use that word as much as possible.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking scoundrel in a lot of cities is the starting point for political action. Like, you're not surprised that anyone would have that.
But in his later years, Rossellini was well regarded among the governors.
He was.
His birthday party would come up, and once you get into near centenarian, everybody reveres you. The governors would gather, and they would swap stories and get advice if they were acting governors. And so, you know, he did go on to sort of a more regal retirement.
Well, he did, and it shouldn't take away from his actual accomplishments during his term. He did accomplish a lot. And certainly did become kind of a gray eminence. And as you get older, this happened to Dave Beck as well. I mean, certain people who are very controversial in their lifetime, but when you hit 90, it all kind of fades away and they become lovable. And
well, I think some people would say LBJ was a scoundrel too.
Sure.
Robert Caro might be one of those. We're talking over the week's news with Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. I'm Marcy Simlin. We'll be back in just a minute here on Weekday.
Which year was the Beatles best? 1965? 1967?
I think what we hear here for the first time with this group is there was no can't. There were no rules that had to be obeyed.
Hear journalist Colin Fleming make the case for the 63-era Beatles, 50 years young. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday morning on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Fry Art Museum, presenting Buster Simpson, Surveyor, the first career retrospective exhibition of the Seattle artist working in the field of urban environmentalism and art in public spaces. Opening June 15th. Details online at frymuseum.org.
55 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Expecting it to turn partly sunny this afternoon with a high of 68. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1022.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and it's Friday, the day we talk over the week's news with our journalist panel, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and Knut Berger. And, Knut, I just have to ask why you are on Science Friday today.
Oh,
look
yeah.
At that
well, because
suit.
I'm a scientist.
Yeah, well, no, yeah, I was. No. I mean, he looks very nice, but and I think you know about a lot of things, but I didn't realize science was in your repertoire.
Oh, well, as I understand it, Ira Flatow, who's the host of the show, is here for the Science Week that they've been having at the Seattle Center. And what I was told was that he couldn't spend all that time sitting at the base of the Space Needle and not talk about it and know something about it. So we're going to be talking about the Space Needle.
Okay.
Science of the Space
Needle. The science and engineering of the Space
Needle. Okay. I thought it might have something to do with engineering, but yeah. I saw that you had posted it, and I was wondering, you know, allow as to that you do know most things, so you could be a physicist in addition to a journalist.
Especially in that suit. And
he could be almost anything.
Clearly, we're going to have to take a picture of Knut in his suit and post it. Eli, we delegate you. All right, so this week, a big brouhaha in Seattle City Hall over the tent encampment known as Nicholsville in West Seattle. The council, by a vote of 7-2, proclaimed that the place was going to be shut down on September 1st, and the mayor said he wouldn't stop it.
That's correct. And they also mentioned $500,000 to go toward relocation shelters, maybe some housing in there. I have to say, I am surprised that they're taking this up in an election year, right after a primary, right before a general election. So I'm not sure what's driving all of that. There will be trouble about it, as we saw from the hearing. People are very, very animated about this topic. And so where will these people go? There was a column that was written that talked about they go back to the green belts, to the freeway underpasses, overpasses, the whole bit. So it's not going to be clean and simple.
And perhaps the reason it comes up in an election year, well, first of all, we're in year 9 of the 10-year plan to end homelessness, so there may just be some pressure from that. It's a problem, so people need to deal with it. But also, it puts the mayor in a hard spot. It's something that's going to be challenging for him to navigate. One of the interesting things to me, and this was raised on Slog by Anna Menard, is that the council now suddenly has all this money to put toward housing the people in Nicholsville if they're going to be kicked out of Nicholsville. Well, why didn't that money exist before?
Oh, I think I can explain some of it. Okay, so you remember so Seattle never suffered economically as much as King County or state government. It did dip. It's, you know, it was in a downturn just like every other government during the recession. But let's think about a couple things that occurred. Parking rates went up. Parking hours increased. That was said to be, and I forget the number, it was in the 20 million range, somewhere around there. That was said to be essential to balance the budget. This is about, what, 2-3 years ago, something like that. So they did fine-tune some of the parking and everything, but there's still plus revenue on parking money. Then along came the library levy, which sort of helps with that part of the budget. Voters approved it, so they have money. To me, this Seattle budget is more flush than people realize. They never experienced the kind of downturn some of the other governments did. And so now that things are picking back up, they have some dough.
And yet we still haven't solved the problem, because if it's dependent on cyclical revenue influxes, then at a certain point, the people who are going to benefit from new housing options that the council provide won't be able to when the council pares back.
Well, one of the interesting things, we spoke to Tim Harris from Real Change earlier in the week, and it's not so much a matter of this $500,000 for relocation. There is also a sort of tent ideology about
That's a great thing.
You know, the collective self-governance that goes on in tent cities, as opposed to a city-run bricks and mortar shelter, and that there is a significant group of people in the city that or people who live in encampments who prefer that.
And I think what the city has said is, we disagree with that ideology. We're not going to indulge it anymore. As I understand it, the council's position, and there actually is some support for that I see. We had a report in the Stranger about a sexual assault that occurred in Nicholsville and was not handled well by their self-governing structures.
Well, all the stories document troubles in these kinds of tent cities. There are troubles. They're not without problems. But as you said, so there's this whole range of homeless folks and the different options that they prefer. Some prefer shelters. Some prefer these kind. Some prefer to be sort of more isolated in the green belts. It's just a range of preferences in a way.
Well, every regulated system has problems also. If you're worried about rape and sexual assault, look at the military. I mean, we have highly regulated environments where there's a problem. I think the thing is, you have to have a real broad menu to deal with the issues. And I think the idea of taking Nicholsville or Nicholsville's, and I don't know why, maybe they should be called McGinnville's now, or whatever. I mean, I'm not sure why he gets tagged with the permanent title. But anyway, I think they are part of the answer. I think they do address some of the issues that Danny Westney raised in his column about people moving into the green belts and parks and that kind of thing. And I think it is there's a dimension of it that is part of being a big city. I mean, you know, just globally, I mean, people say, well, why do people come to Seattle? And is it the climate? Is it that we're the police?
Oh, it's got to be the rain.
Or, you know, what, you know, and that kind of thing. Well, everybody is coming to cities because that's where economic activity is. And if you look at urban growth worldwide, a huge percentage of it, maybe even the majority of it, is in what they call self-built communities, meaning shanty towns, meaning people are coming to these areas. They don't have the resources, so they build their own place. We're not dealing with anything on the scale they're dealing with in Asia or Latin America or anything like that. But it doesn't mean there isn't a dimension of that issue affecting us. And I think you have to be realistic about it. I think Nicholsville addresses a slice of that. And then the other issue, and this comes back to things we've talked about before in terms of the atmosphere in downtown Seattle that the retailers are unhappy with, or even on Capitol Hill where there are a lot of mentally disturbed people on the street. But another part of the whole slice is not just putting a roof over people's head. I mean, that is part of it. Another part of it is dealing with the issues that get people to that place and to that point. And that's, again, goes back to my point about the budget and about other issues. We have a severe mental health crisis in terms of people on the street. You just have to walk through Pike Pine or walk through Westlake and you'll see it. And we're not dealing with it. And I think that does have to be. I mean, there are people actually, you know, passionately working on that, but it's going to take money.
People used to blame that on deinstitutionalization in the Reagan era, which at this point is 30-some years ago. I mean, we can't point the finger at that. So
yes, we can.
Okay.
I think we still can. There's it's our failure to adequately plan for deinstitutionalization, or at least deal with the realities that it creates. There's a great and very long post by Harold Pollack at the Washington Post's Wonk blog this week that talks about how deinstitutionalization had very, very positive impacts on disabled people. So people who were
physically
intellectual disabilities and other disabilities like that, who were institutionalized and just forgotten about when they could have been cared for in community settings. And that this has been easier for the government and the culture to deal with, you know, treating these people in community clinics, but that the mental health aspect of this, where people who are not severely mentally ill enough to be permanently housed in institutions were moved out, that aspect is more complicated and hasn't received the attention or funding that it needs to be handled at a community level. And so it comes back to exactly what Knut was saying, that the state has failed to provide the attention and the money that this needs, and you see the result on the street.
Well, so is it the state? That was my question. At what level of government do we put the onus?
It's the state. The state, I mean, King County has money to do a lot of this, and it can do what it can, but you need state resources to deal with a problem like
for
this.
People who follow this, this has not been handled since what happened is time has passed, but mm-hmm. the issue is still straight away in front of us in many, you know, in many police situations, in funding from the state, from the county, that it's just something that people talk about and then it never gets enough attention.
And one incentive for the state to pay more attention, and I don't understand why this incentive isn't more motivating, is that, you know, we replace the institutions of yore with prisons. The people who are dealing with these issues, the citizens who need help, end up being incarcerated. And then our prison system spends a tremendous amount of money housing people that it's not equipped to deal with effectively.
When we talk about state funding, we constantly talk about what's getting cut, and everything now is aimed at the K-12 pot of money. So are mental health services part of the victim?
Well, let's consider one idea. One of the ideas that the Senate has been promoting, either to have it adopted as part of the policy of the budget or as a referendum that would go to voters, would be to cap non-education funding at a sort of, if you remember, Initiative 601, population and inflation as a measure of that. And so that funding would be tamped in some way. And now that hasn't gotten through. That is one of the holdups. That's one of the, I forget, there's three holdups that the Senate is very much trying to have become state policy.
And if you think about that, it means, just quickly, it means that we are satisfied with the level of funding for, say, mental health services in the state, and no one is satisfied with that.
Yeah, it's an incredibly bad idea, because it assumes that everything that's getting money other than education is maxed out, and it doesn't give the state the flexibility to really increase budgets that aren't affected necessarily by population growth or volume, but might be where you want to have a policy initiative, And I think there's a really funny, I mean, every side to some degree talks out of both sides of their mouths. But one of the things you constantly have heard from Republicans in particular has been, you know, that when the legislature overturns an Iman initiative, this is a violation of the will of the people. And here they're trying to essentially impose a budget situation which was rejected by the people of Washington when they voted against Rob McKenna. Rob McKenna essentially proposed this exact strategy for dealing with the budget, which was fund education and cap everything else. And it's for people who are trying to make an argument, a conservative argument about management, it's stupid. It's bad management. And it would lock us in. It might sound good, but it would lock us in to decisions that we've made that are bad decisions that need to be unmade during tough budgetary times, let alone making commitments to things that we see in the future.
There will be many questions, of course, too, as to the wisdom of having voters sort of budget by initiative, because it's a general principle that would be put before folks, and it would sound probably good to a lot of people. I mean, the voters here have approved Initiative 601 type measures many a time. But the question would be then, what would be the practical application of that, and how would that play out over time?
So to go back to the direct service provision, whether it's to the homeless or to homeless mentally ill or to mentally ill who aren't homeless or any of the other pressing needs, and we could all write up, you know, lists that are, you know, 28 lines long. There's the state who's cutting. It's the county and the city, I think, who initiated this 10-year plan to end homelessness.
That's out of the county.
Right. It wasn't a state plan.
Right.
So, I mean, as far as I know, the county isn't flush with cash right now either.
The county is not flush either. No, it's not. So
do those programs go at the county level? Are they getting...
Sometimes we come up with ideas that aren't funded.
Yeah. Well, a lot of state funding flows to those local programs.
Correct.
In other words,
that's
the county
not self-funded.
Programs, the city program. Yes, they're getting money from the state. They're getting money from the federal government. They're getting money from other resources, but they're the local agencies that can provide the counseling or provide the services. At that level, and they need to be more, not only more generously funded, there needs to be additional programs and additional creativity applied to that area.
Just to throw in while we're on this topic of money, yesterday Patty Murray convened a subcommittee to talk about transportation needs at the federal level, and she was quite hot under the collar when I talked to her about long-sighted versus short-sighted planning, and especially when it comes to money. I mean, nobody has a price tag for how much it would cost to fix transportation infrastructure because the number's too high. They had just announced $15.6 million, and that would pay for the temporary bridge and part of the construction of the permanent. That's one bridge out of the thousands that need fixing. And so mostly she was hot under the collar about congressional will, and I guess we're talking about legislative will at this point in time.
Well, nothing helps an argument like that, like a bridge that drops into the water. And so that becomes a symbol and a good argument for long-term planning, and she didn't miss that opportunity, did she?
But we don't. I mean, we've got people on the streets or people living in leaky tents with rats outside. Isn't that a symbol?
Well, I think what I see here is a reminder of problems that are too big for local jurisdictions to solve. When you're talking about homelessness or providing mental health treatment or just social service in general in Seattle and King County, that is an issue that needs state support. Just like when a bridge falls down over the Skagit River, the state needs to lean on the federal government to get it fixed. So that's what I see here, just this reminder that local jurisdictions are not self-sufficient. They can't be. They need help from the larger, higher levels of government that we all pay into with our taxes.
And the day the bridge went down, there were the politicians in Washington, D.C. spoke really quickly about the need for a federal assist, at least, in replacing it.
We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger. I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday on KUOW.
55 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy. Forecast says it's going to be partly sunny this afternoon with a high of 68. You count on KUOW to provide you with intelligent reporting that nurtures your knowledge. KUOW takes you beyond the headlines, gives you a deeper perspective on important issues. Now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make it online at KUOW.org by June 30th. And thanks.
Neil Gaiman says he's never wanted to be the kind of author who can be classified.
Never to be in a place where if I went to my publisher and said, I want to do this, they'd say, are you out of your mind?
So if he said,
okay, so the next book, it's going to be a pornographic cookbook, they probably wouldn't blink.
Neil Gaiman's new book, No Recipes, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law organization that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right. Leveraging the power of law to preserve Washington's natural resources, protect public health, and combat climate change. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:41. Research shows that we're overdue for a major earthquake here in the Pacific Northwest. How well prepared are we for a major earthquake? Not well enough, apparently. That full report in the news at 11.
Speaking of earthquakes, we're going to be talking with Seattle Times reporter Sandy Doughton, who's just written a book called Full Rip 9.0, which have you read?
Let me put a plug in for that.
Oh, my God. Scared the pants off me.
I read that book. You obviously read that book.
Yes.
It's terrific because she wraps up the science. One of the shocking things is how much we've learned about the seismic character of this region.
It's too scary.
But how recent that knowledge is.
Yeah.
We didn't know for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
You thought tectonic plates were forever, right?
Exactly. and a lot of this is new stuff in the 80s, 90s, and even now.
Okay, so apologies, Sandy. You probably aren't listening, but I read this book, and then I had this horrible nightmare that this 9.5 earthquake hit in Capitol Hill dissolved into Lake Union while I was on a boat on Lake Union. That's how vivid this book is. So,
wow.
We're going to be talking to her Tuesday, just, you know, to get you all ready for I'm not sure what.
I better go buy water today.
Everybody be prepared.
Preparedness.
Be prepared. That can be a whole subject in and of itself. We'll talk about that next week after I talk to Sandy and I give you the book to take home. We started off talking about closing Nicholsville September 1st and what the wisdom or question of whether we should be doing that in the year of a mayoral election. Speaking of mayors, because this primary thing is happening in less than 2 months at this point in time, Ed Murray picked up sort of a key endorsement this week.
Yeah, this race is starting to take a little bit of shape. Last week we talked about how mushy it is, but now that you have the Democratic district organizations endorsing they're still all over the map, but Ed Murray got his what he likes to refer to as his childhood home of Alki in the 34th district. He got that one this week.
He's from West Seattle.
Well, he's always told me he went to elementary school over there. He sat in front of or behind Tim Cease in some classroom or something. He now lives on Capitol Hill, so that's different. But everybody always, you know, at all these forums, they all say, I was here first, my people were here first, you know, I'm a native Washingtonian.
Yeah, the more places you can claim as connected to your childhood, the better as a politician.
Well, I was wondering.
He is a native Washingtonian, not a native Seattleite.
Well, I was wondering whether, you know, that West Seattle, there's sort of a talisman. Greg Nichols was from West Seattle, Dow Constantine's from West Seattle, whether there's some kind of
charm. It's a cult, isn't it?
I don't know. I like West Seattle, but is it like a charm that if you can claim some kind of connection to it, some familial root to West Seattle, that in addition to getting your endorsement from the politicians, you know, there's some kind of juju that.
Well, the person who does the best says West Seattle plus Capitol Hill plus some North End thing, you know, that's probably the most winning strategy.
Yeah, well, it's important political ground to win because people can contend for it.
So do you agree with Joni Knuth that the mushy race is starting to take shape with this?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like the business community is covering all of its bets. So you see money going to McGinn, money going to Murray, some money going to Harrell. And they're basically all vying for being the not McGinn person who gets through the primary, and maybe two of them will get through. It's unclear what's going to happen. Certainly, the endorsement, that was a good thing for Ed Murray. I think there's still a way in which people don't. Ed Murray, because of the legislative sessions and the, you know, the amount of time he spent in Olympia, I don't think people could sit down and name three real Seattle local issues and where Ed Murray stands on them. In other words, I don't think he's still seen. But what he is somebody who, with experience, you know, a great demeanor, somebody who's got a lot of respect from people, liberals in particular. And I think he's a very serviceable you know, alternative to the incumbent.
And he's probably really tired of being in Olympia now that he's in extra session, too.
And that's a reminder of the double-edged sword, mm-hmm. to his experience claim and to his current job in Olympia. I thought something about the 36th vote that was interesting was that...
34th or 36th?
34th district?
34th, sorry.
34th.
That they went through, I think, two rounds, if I understand it right. Mm-hmm. And in, so I see that as potentially mirroring the primary general dynamic that we're going to have. And so in the first round, Murray obviously got through and McGinn got through. The, you know, it's kind of a two-man race that we're starting to see shape up. And but once you get into this two-man race between Murray and McGinn, at least in West Seattle, when they vote again, Murray walks away with it in a landslide.
Once we get rid of the other...
Once you get rid of the others and things are thrown into stark relief between McGinn and Murray. And so that's very positive for Murray's camp. They almost would want at this point to get through the primary, I think, with McGinn.
I've seen that phenomenon happen in, elsewhere also, which is... Is McGinn does well when the comparatively when the votes are split, but there's a coalescing of
everybody.
He doesn't pick up Harrell votes or Steinbrück votes or that kind of thing. It all goes to the opponent. That suggests that even if he does get through the primary, McGinn has a real challenge, especially when his poll ratings were kind of below where Nichols were when he
lost.
Didn't make it through a primary. It really it suggests that. Afterwards, whoever gets through that, if McGinn also gets through, is going to have the benefit of a fairly significant anti-McGinn vote.
Well, I want to go back to the, you know, how stymied or Ed Murray might be because the legislature's got him sort of locked up and busy. A couple of things. What candidates do is they sell what they have to offer. So Ed Murray can't come in and say he did this Seattle issue.
Because he wasn't there.
He can say... Well, I've worked really hard long-term with people of disparate political views to get gay marriage. So that's what he talks about, working with people from around the state on tough issues. You have Peter Steinbrück who says, I would come in ready to hit the ground running because I know Seattle issues. He did spend many years on the city council. He does know the issues as of that moment and presumably of this moment. So you always sell what you have. You sell what you have to offer. You emphasize that. So McGinn, what is he talking about right now? He's talking about a 30-year low in the crime rate, because during his time, it so happens that this occurred.
And we've seen before that this dynamic of having a lack of political or legislative experience in Seattle and the nitty-gritty of city politics can actually be an asset. We elected McGinn. Mm-hmm. Who had no paper trail of decisions in any political
office. Then the entire city turned on him and started barking at him for having no experience running the city.
Right. But I think that perception has shifted, that you know, people now feel, okay, well, he went up a very steep four-year-long learning curve, but here he is. And a question that I've heard people ask is, will we watch Murray go up that same learning curve? With his lack of experience in the city of Seattle. And so is it better to stick with the guy that you know and who knows the city a lot better now than someone who is going to, you know, be thrown into the deep end of the pool again?
Right. And that's an interesting thing, because McGinn has the sort of devil you know argument.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's some in the business community. I think there are people saying, well, gee, maybe he's not so bad. Maybe, you know, I know what to expect. You know, that you can work with him. I mean, I think that he has an advantage there. The two of the candidates, I think, that have what Eli's talking about, which is that sort of insider and outsider cred,
mm-hmm.
are Murray and Steinbrück, because Peter's not on the city council, but he was for a long time. But, you know, he was out, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas at Murray, I do think there is a way his remove from Seattle is to some degree an advantage.
Hmm. Just a notice from Jason, producer, reminds me to tell everybody that all nine candidates are going to come on KUOW in the month of July. So you'll get at all nine of.
Do you have enough microphones for that?
Not at the same time.
Oh.
Good idea.
It's like serial monogamy. Sorry. We'll bring them in one at a time and get to know them. I have a question, just a sort of equal time question. My colleague, Dave Beck, not to be confused with the Teamster that Knut was talking about earlier, his daughter just graduated from Garfield High School, and the speaker was Bruce Harrell. There are 18-year-olds. They are a voting age. Can you do that?
This is a very interesting point that you bring up, because I was flashing back 4 years ago to the phenomenon, essentially, of Mike McGinn getting elected without sort of traditional groups supporting him. It was an interesting get-out-the-vote situation for a primary. And so to me, when you look at, you know, the candidates this year, whoever is playing that, don't forget, very early August primary in the middle of summer when everybody's hugely distracted by the sun in Seattle, the campaign that gets their voters to say, we're going, you know, this was sort of like a combination of the Sierra Club and the Cascade Bicycle folks and young people who were motivated, and heavy effort to get their vote out is what got McGinn through. And so I do think that's a factor, especially in a race that's going to divide, so, you know, in small numbers, because you're going to have four probably major candidates dividing that 100.
So we have to provide equal time to candidates, but a high school commencement didn't need to have 9 speakers.
Well, he's a graduate.
Yes, he
was
a
valedictorian.
Indeed.
He was, okay. I mean, he is a product of Garfield. So I don't know how you could
I would
argue
guess
that
it wasn't a political speech.
I don't think it was a political speech.
If he was smart, he would have kept it from his political campaign.
Hopefully he kept it sort of upbeat, unlike some other people.
I have to recuse myself from that conversation. I was at the Roosevelt High School commencement, which hit the newspaper. Who knew that a high school commencement could hit a newspaper? But let's move on. Noel says, Mike McGinn is beginning to sound like Bud Clark. Bud even survived a recall. You think?
In what way? I'd want to know in what way, because he's sort of getting his act together and sort of proclaiming that, you know, crime is down, that, you know, that he tried to get the NBA, that he's listening to the department. I don't know the exact way that he's doing that.
Well, he's learned on the job. I think most people would say that he's doing a better job than he was doing before. He's also a great campaigner. I mean, you can't underestimate his ability. He's good on the campaign trail. Yeah. He knows how to work a room. He knows how to talk to his opponents and that kind of thing. You know, don't count him out.
I think another thing that people underestimated is that McGinn is a great ideological fit for the city. Find me an issue where McGinn is on the wrong side of a majority of Seattleites. It's very hard to find one. And there are issues that you can raise with Ed Murray, you know, state funding issues. And McGinn has and certainly will continue to raise them where, you know, he'll suggest that Murray has done things that were against Seattle's interests and so on. Mm-hmm. But I just think that ideological sink is a very powerful tool for McGinn, very mm-hmm. powerful selling point.
The candidate Mike McGinn needs to beat is the Mike McGinn his first year in office.
Exactly.
He set a tone and a public perception that some of it has truth in it that dogs him to this day. And that is what he needs to overcome. He's showing signs of doing that. But I would say that the endorsement process with the Democratic legislative districts is not a good sign for him.
Well, let's go back to that first year for a minute. And, you know, he spent a lot of time fighting about the tunnel. So if you are in a battle with your council, with a lot of, you know, business people, state people, which is really what that scene looked like, mm-hmm. you have less time to say, let me look over here at the police department. He was not focused on the police department that year. He wasn't focused on he became more focused, certainly. But that year was a very distracting year for a new mayor coming in. As you know, you're the sort of image that you create for yourself your first year becomes the image that you either have to work to change or becomes printed on you. And so he was in a battle that whole year about the tunnels. So that really was a distracting project for him, shall we say, and it didn't go his way. And so as time went on, then that was settled. So he had time to work on the sort of day-to-day basics of government.
And that gets to a more meta issue that still dogs him, which is if he's an ideological fit, he's not a dispositional fit, or at least people really feel that. They perceive that, and that's why you're seeing this ceiling, I think, of support for him. When the votes are split 9 ways, he and Murray will get through in some of these district forums. But when it's just him and someone else, he has a hard time getting above a certain threshold of support.
I want to touch briefly before we end this hour on another move in the Seattle City Hall, which one, there's sort of the move toward district election of city council candidates, petitions going wild, and also public financing of these campaigns with a property tax addition. Because we don't have enough property taxes in the city of Seattle. Why not $4 more on your house or whatever it is? Do you think we're going to actually see district city council elections in Seattle?
Well, it's come up a couple times. The voters have turned it down a few times. This time is a little bit different because there's a map that you can look at and decide if you want to be sort of connected to the group that you've been drawn with.
Yes.
But the voters have looked at this a couple times. You know, the arguments, or there's some compelling arguments on both sides, but the voters have turned this down. I believe it's two or three times. I don't know if this time will be different.
I think both of those efforts are trying to solve a problem, which is to enable people to run for city council and have the potential of winning where money is not the only factor or a big name. I mean, we have a thing where candidates here have an advantage if they were on television for a long time or in the media for a long time. You know, Gene Godden, Jim Compton, mm-hmm. Charles Royer, that's an asset. Or if you can raise a lot of money. The candidates don't like spending all the time raising money, but it also really the expense of the citywide races is such that the idea is that having people run for districts will make it cheaper to run a campaign because you'll only have to please a small part of the city. I mean, there's downsides to it, no question. We used to have wards here. I mean, we used to have, and one reason they were broken up in a reform effort was because of machine mm-hmm. corruption. And that is one of the hazards. Public financing, a lot of people like the idea of it. It would enable people to, enable smaller funded people to run a decent race. A lot of people question whether that's a solution either.
My question is, what happens if both of these things pass and we have district elections and public financing, but you have this smaller pool to draw from as a candidate in your district and you need to get these $610 donations to get the city match? I mean, this is a little down in the weeds, but I wonder if people have thought out that scenario.
I don't think they're coordinated in that way.
It's interesting. I'm going to give our listener, M, the last word. She says, Mike McGinn was elected in my mind because his opponent knew nothing about city government and had a non-existent voting record. The only thing Malahan did right was gather excellent advisors, but not enough to overcome awfulness. That's the worst thing that McGinn did, gather horrible advisors and then stick to them. And with that, journalists, we end this conversation. Knut Berger, the Mossbeck at Crosscut.com, will be on Science Friday in an hour or so. And you can check it out on KUOW2, our second program service. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, will not be on Science Friday, but will be back on our air. Great to have you here. Katie Sewell produces Weekday with Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Bernard Ouellette, the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Have a great weekend.
#1059. The wildfires in Colorado have now destroyed hundreds of homes and killed at least two people. An update in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, renewing their commitment during June's National Dairy Month to healthy cows, product quality, and a clean environment. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
A composer recorded sounds of a bridge in New York City. Hundreds of metal cables, bolts, and girders. Those sounds became the notes for this composition. Now he's using the same technique on a structure in Paris.
Believe it or not, we're getting things that sound like timpanis, things that sound like...